disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo. On some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been.
Welcome. This is America, April 6, 2019. On this show, we feature an interview with somebody from Wounded Knee, which is located on the Pine Ridge Reservation on Oglala Lakota land. About the recent flooding, the government response, self-organization in the face of the storm, and mutual aid disaster relief efforts. We then feature a discussion on the growing crisis along the border and what it means that both Trump and the DHS are pushing for more power and draconian authority to intern, deport, and manage migrants and refugees. All this and more, but first, let's get to some headlines. First, in some bad news, there's been a slew of neo-Nazi and white nationalist attacks. First, in Tennessee, there was an arson at the Highlander Research and Education Center, a long-running hub for organizing the South in Appalachia. Found at the scene of the attack was a symbol once used by the Romanian Iron Guard, a fascist and violently anti-Semitic group which was promoted almost entirely by Matthew Heimbach and the former Traditionalist Workers Party. Meanwhile, in Louisiana, there's also been a string of arson attacks against three black churches, while in Oklahoma City and in Maryland, there have been racist graffiti attacks, as well as at the university in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Meanwhile, new documents obtained by the Huffington Post show that Katie Gorka, a Trump administration political appointee in the Department of Homeland Security, suggested in July 2017 email that the agency, which had just canceled funding for a group dedicated to de-radicalizing white supremacists, redirect its efforts to focus on a real threat, anti-fascists. On April 12th, independent truck drivers are gearing up to launch a nationwide slow-down action in response to new legislation, working conditions, and attacks on pay. As Business Insider wrote, truck drivers whose salaries have plummeted as much by 50% since the 1980s feel that they become less and less respected over time. The April 12th action follows a series of other slowdown actions across the U.S. and is being organized over social media through the growing Black Smoke Matters movement, which is made up of a variety of groups and Facebook hubs. Central to the growth of the movement has been widespread rejection of the Electronic Logging Device, or ELD, mandate, and other regulations which drivers say make them more unsafe and negatively affects their pay. The ELD mandate has been supported by both parties, as well as the In Trucker Circles, much-hated American Trucking Association, or the ATA. The decrease in non-union trucking, along with the passage of the Motor Carrier Act of 1980, has led to a drastic decrease in both the overall pay of drivers and regulations ensuring good conditions. As pay decreased, drivers pushed themselves harder and harder to earn more per mile, which in turn led some drivers to get into fatal accidents. The ELD mandate is an attempt by the state to solve this problem, but drivers still remain up against an industry that depends on selling low-priced consumer goods made possible by undercutting their own workers, the drivers. The situation also is why many elites within the industry are pushing hard for complete automation and the growth of self-driving trucks, which would displace a massive part of the U.S. workforce. This displacement is expected by the elites as inevitable as part of economic progress. As in Bob Woodward's book, Fear, about the Trump presidency, Trump is warned by his economic advisors that under his reign, upwards of 25% of the American workforce will lose their jobs due to automation in trucking and other driving-based careers. Despite being called domestic terrorists by some truckers, no one doubts that trucking strikes can have enormous impacts on the economy, in which over 70% of freight is transported by trucks. Truck drivers struck for only a few days, it would mean that everything from gas stations to hospitals would run out of supplies. In other labor news, the Burgerville Workers Union in the Portland, Oregon area is now celebrating two more stores that have officially voted to join the union. In the southeast, the fight against the Mountain Valley Pipeline, or the MVP, continues with Appalachians Against Pipelines writing, quote, "The elephant's tree sits have a new resident, Scott Zimmer, a 69-year-old grandfather from Virginia, has relieved one of the sitters and is occupying one of the tree sits to protect some of the last remaining trees in the path of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. The blockade outside of Elliston has been blockading the MVP for 213 days and counting. Scott says, quote, "I have decided to take action to address the urgent issue of climate change and encourage others to do so as well. By occupying a tree sit in the path of a Mountain Valley Pipeline, I am adding my voice to those who are fighting to slow down and stop the burning of fossil fuels, which are the primary cause of climate change. Scott's home is close to the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which he's been fighting for many years. He's taken a stand with the communities of Southwest Virginia as an act of solidarity to all those being harmed by MVP construction. In other news, journalist Manuel Duran is fighting deportation after literally spending a year in jail for covering immigration protests that shut down a freeway. In what is being reported as the staggering 26th officer-involved shooting in Atlanta this year alone, Oscar Kane was shot and killed by police and is being remembered as a longtime organizer against police violence. Kane's death also marks yet another young African-American who was deeply involved in the Ferguson uprising who has died under questionable circumstances. In Panama City, Florida, hundreds of Hurricane Michael survivors face eviction as a FEMA program is scheduled to end. Finally, in Kentucky, university students are launching a hunger strike for not being able to afford food on campus. That's going to do it for us today. Enjoy the interview and the discussion, and we will see you soon. But first, here's some upcoming events. April 19th through the 21st, in Prescott, Arizona, there is a three-day anti-fascist gathering. On April 28th, there is an all-out mobilization against a white nationalist patriot militia holding a rally in Long Beach, California. On May 4th, there is an all-out mobilization in Toronto against the anti-Muslim group Pegida. On May 18th, there is a mobilization against the American Renaissance Conference. On Sunday, May 25th, there is a mobilization against the KKK in Dayton, Ohio. May 18th through the 19th, come out to the Revolutionary Organizing Against Racism Conference in the Bay Area. June 14th through the 17th, the Fight Toxic Prisons Conference is going down in Gainesville, Florida. On June 19th, there is the Mobilize Against Nationalist Solutions Conference happening in Tennessee. August 3rd through the 11th, the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking is holding a gathering in Worcester, Massachusetts. On August 16th through the 18th, there is going to be an Indigenous Anarchist Convergence in so-called Flagstaff, Arizona. Thanks again for listening. We will see you soon.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Only in America.
The United States of America is the demon of the world.
I'm a product of America. Psychotic from narcotics, born consumers of STDs, yeah, I got it. A victim of a media machine, violence and lust, top to bottom and greedy in between. I'm a menace with big dreams, and no morals to stop me from none. I gotta get mine, that's why I went and caught me a gun. Police would put me in a cage if they could lock me in one. These dudes would kill me out of jealousy, they pop me and run. Shit, I'm bloodthirsty too, we were raised with foul ways. It's in everything we watch and listen to nowadays. And the younger kids are way more depraved. We're hunger for beef, some will run around the neighborhood crazed. Land of the free, home of the brave, my world is a morgue. One day I lay alone in the grave, still my dome is enslaved. In the haze of the power I crave, I can't help it, this is how I was raised.
My synergy's a conspiracy, I hit the scene like spinning guillotines. Villains creep through your village deep while idiots sleep. I'm awake, dominate, annihilate, I violate, obliterate, incinerate, exterminate. I'm an American. Murder, hate, violence, and war, tyrants galore, riots and more, violent uproar, the rise of the poor, we monitor all. Everybody signed at the door, so walk out now, but you may never survive at all. We murder capitals, turn hometowns to homicides, DNT, 1080 counter lines. My take on society is beyond the fabrications that they prophesize. Colonize through modern lies, economize and sodomize. Humanity every day, vanity's rape, gravity take, hold it, your sanity wait. This is not an exercise, this is real life, salvage your fate. Contaminated planet of hate, the children sing a passage of faith. Lavish taste was the train of Alexander the Great. Savage grace gravitate to mathematics and space. Like Dr.
I'm completely irrational, I'm unrealistic. Got the right to talk shit, got the right to bear arms. I bring disease, I bring famine with some guns and some bombs. Got my four-horse squad, my lightning rod. Men of beef with the devil, not fight for God. I'm from the Highland clans, I'm on some stolen lands. The crown jewel in the new world, order plans. Get your quarter cam, place your order, man. Step up right this way to the slaughter land. While every one of your freedoms got emancipated, you just surfed on the net, and you masturbated. We got hoes, we got thugs, we got sex, we got drugs, we got laws, we got all the right people to break them. We got blood, you got oil, you got land we can spoil, we got bigger, better guns, yo, I know we can take on. I'm an American.
That was a hustler holding a derringer, wearing a black hoodie and living life like a predator. Hated his life, embarrassed to being alone. The little he knows will get him, my past assed out of his head blown. It's known we live in the land of the lost. Could have been a leader or put on the cross. Needed to push for his cause, breaking laws, now we spraying his rod inside of a cell. He put his whole family through hell and broke it apart, breaking his mother's heart. He started in school when he was on the path to losing his mind. Whatever happened to no child gets left behind. Just another slogan I'm hoping that you can comprehend. I'm born to struggle, I'm an American.
I'm an American.
Okay, would you like to introduce yourself and where you're calling from real quick?
Yeah, hi, my name is Clarence Rowland. I am calling from Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation.
So can you just tell us a little bit about what's been happening the past couple of weeks? We understand there's been massive flooding that's caused a lot of problems out there.
Yeah, we had the bomb cyclone that came by, through here, almost a couple of weeks ago. It dropped a lot of snow here, and so when the weather got nice, it just all turned to water, and it just started causing flooding all over the reservation. As far as that goes, that was the first time we've ever had a bomb cyclone like that come through here. I mean, it's the first time I ever heard of it.
Oh, wow. And what has been, obviously people have seen a lot of the photos. It looks like people I don't know what it's like now, but it seemed like initially people were dealing with a couple feet of water, like affecting people's homes and stuff. And also people were kind of like flooded out. Like some of the land was like almost like an island, it seemed like. I don't know if you want to comment on just the effects of the flooding.
Yeah, like right here where I live in Wounded Knee, It was pretty bad. Like, first, it was the snow that hit, so we were pretty much trapped in here. And the snowplow couldn't make it. So, after that, I'd say about another few days later, when all the snow started melting, and it just caused so much flooding. There was a lot of rain water, the snow water that was coming through our homes here, and it was going down to the creek, which was, really causing a lot of flooding, and it took out a lot of roads and bridges, down the way. And it flooded a few homes that was kind of on their way to Madison Community. It's a short ways from here. Yeah, and then our dams, too. Like, a lot of dams are, overflowing to the point where they could break and, put lives in danger.
Oh, wow.
And the water line breaks, too. Like, our main water lines, I think we have two main breaks in our water lines here. In our community, we get our water from a pipeline. It comes from the Missouri, so it's all pipeline here for our community, our whole reservation. And so it was just water shortage. They had to put warnings out for people not to use the water for drinking or cooking or... so it was that was a really short, our shortage on water was kind of, it was an emergency because people didn't have the water.
Yeah, that's one of the things that was written about in one of the media pieces was that the National Guard, when they came out, they were bringing water that, was non-potable, they said. Like, basically, you couldn't use it at all.
Yeah, the South Dakota state governor, Christy Nolan, sent her response was, the National Guard, and they brought the water buffaloes to the reservation and into different communities. But the water was great and very undrinkable, and it had floaters in it, so it wasn't usable. People just were pretty much able to use it to flush toilets, and that was it. So that was kind of a shock.
How were people getting drinking water then?
Water. People started sending us water. At first, there was none. We didn't know how long this was going to last. And, so that's why there was a call put out for help to the reservation. So people started bringing water, which is a good thing because it really came in handy to help the people.
Yeah. Can you just describe, because, a lot of the articles that have come out have just mentioned just how kind of weak and slow the response from the government was, in compared to the rest of the Midwest, which was also affected. And obviously, that's connected to colonialism and
you know, everything that, you know, we're all very well aware of. But can you just describe the National Guard and, like, the state, like, coming onto these areas and just kind of, like, how they acted, I mean, and what they did?
No, it was a really slow response, you know, and I know they did come and help people out of their homes that were stranded, so, which was a really good thing because there was some homes were flooded out and people were, like, stranded at their homes with no way to get out to get water or food. A lot of the bridges washed out and a lot of the roads. So, I guess it's good. I'd say, you know, it's good that they came and they helped rescue people. And flush the toilets. But, yeah, it's, I don't know, it's been a really slow response, and the South Dakota governor himself said it would take weeks before we could even see any kind of disaster relief, federal disaster relief coming here, so.
Oh, wow. Well, can you talk a little bit about just how people have kind of stepped up and offered mutual aid and just, like, brought, you know, you were saying water and other stuff out?
Yeah, like, in my community, there was a lot of flooding, and, you know, Pine Ridge Reservation, there's a lot of poverty here, and there's not many jobs on our reservation, and not many resources, so... Even, you know, we weren't prepared for this kind of storm. You know, and we don't even have a big grocery store. Like, our main one's closed right now. So people have been having to travel out off the reservation to get food. And so, you know, our whole tribe was not equipped to deal with this kind of situation. And, you know, it was terrible. But people started stepping up in their own communities and getting help and volunteering and cooking and opening up, you know, the community youth shelters or, you know, the community youth or, like, just the buildings, you know, to keep people there during the flood, so, which was a great thing. So, like, in our community, too, our youth center, we don't have no resources here in our community, so it was without power, they don't have water, and, we got together with our district to help us get the lights on, and we opened it up at the distribution center. So people have been just, you know, kind of jumped into action and been helping each other out. And I know, like, a couple of the tribes have been sending water towards us, too. So,
oh, great.
Which is a really big thing. But, yeah, I've been helping, like, cook. I know we had some friends from Colorado that made it up here to bring food to distribute, and also they wanted to cook and feed people. So we did that for about 5 days straight, just cooking and feeding the community and the volunteers. And we also made a trip out to another community on a reservation, which is known as Registered Community. It's kind of way out there. But, you know, they were kind of left out, so we made it out there. It was an 80-mile drive, but we spent the whole community, which was it was a good blessing. It felt good to do that, and I'm really thankful that our friends from Colorado were able to, you know, jump into action and bring some kind of relief to us. It's really appreciated, anyway.
Great.
Much.
Well, if people are listening now and they want to donate either with money or supplies, I know there's a couple links up right now. Different groups have different fundraisers that are going. But do you want to say anything about where people should donate or how they can help?
Well, at this point, I don't know any organizations right here, like, on the reservation that are, or any, like, groups that are raising money, but just our tribe. Our tribe has a, you know, you can go to their website and donate there. Or, you know, like, I would recommend, like, donating to a small group like Fort Collins Food Not Bombs group, because, you know, they are really doing the groundwork and they're getting out here and they're getting relief out here. So
awesome.
You know, I would recommend Food Not Bombs from Fort Collins.
Okay. Anything else you want to say?
I would just like to say, you know, thank you to everybody who's been sending help here to the reservation. You know, it's reaching the people, and it's really, really needed, and it's really appreciated. You know, and, yeah, I would just like to say thank you to everybody.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us, and hopefully people continue to mobilize. And obviously, even after the water kind of goes down, there's still a lot of work to do. I know the impact often is even greater after the water leaves and people have to deal with the effect on their homes and stuff.
Yes. I do hope that people can get their homes repaired, or, you know, like, hopefully they should. Because I'm not too sure what's happening with the people who were, you know, their homes were either destroyed or damaged. I don't know what's happening with them. I don't know how our tribe's going to respond to that, because we don't really have, like I was saying, we don't have the resources to deal with that kind of issue right now. So I just hope that these families can be helped.
Right. Well, hopefully people that are paying attention now continue to monitor it, and we encourage people to check out a lot of the relief groups. We'll have links in this podcast notes about how to donate to them. But thanks again for talking to us.
Yeah, and also, you know, a lot of us are sending our prayers to Nebraska, our neighbor state, because a lot of the food's grown there, and sad to see a lot of flooding down that way, too. So, it's kind of sad, you know, that our First Nations, you know, we're kind of, we're dealing with climate change here. We're suffering from it. Hopefully people can stand up and, you know, think about our Mother Earth and what's happening. It's only probably going to get worse from here.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, sorry for dragging on, but thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Okay, we are back once again. It's been a very busy week. So much has been happening, you know, just in the aftermath of the Mueller investigation. We talked about this last week, so I don't want to delve on this too much. But, I mean, I think it just really shows the degree in which, you know, this is not, quote, a democratic process. I mean, we had this one guy that was appointed by Trump who read this 300-page document, and then he basically said, oh, there's nothing to worry about, you know, no collusion, blah, blah, blah. Even though the report itself does not exonerate Trump at all. It says, you know, we couldn't necessarily find anything, but that doesn't mean that Trump himself is exonerated. And I don't know. I mean, it's on all sides of how you look at it, whether or not, you know, like as they said on Saturday Night Live last week, you know, I got tricked into believing that the FBI was going to be a vehicle in which, you know, the presidency would ever be held accountable. And also on the other side, that, you know, these people that are close to Trump that have been, you know, basically party insiders for decades that are somehow going to then turn around and be, again, some vehicle of, like, government accountability or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, so for all the liberals out there that forgot that the FBI sucks, you can remember that the FBI sucks now, right? I mean, James Comey oversaw, you know, pretty widespread repression against anarchists and environmentalists and things like that. And so did Robert Mueller.
Muslim, like, community as well, on a massive scale.
Yeah, I mean, we can't forget who these people were, right, and are in a lot of ways. The same kind of baby boomer lefties that, you know, were cheering Mueller on were the same people screaming about the FBI in the 1970s, right? We need to remember who these people were. But I think what's completely fascinating about the fallout from the Mueller investigation ending is how fast things returned to a discourse that exists without Robert Mueller. It was actually kind of amazing. The reason I say that is the polling that came out this week. You know, Republicans, after the Mueller investigation ended, were super, super excited, and the Trump administration was obviously very emboldened, as we'll talk about, because they've been very busy this week. But one of the things that Republicans were saying is, cool, now that this whole, like, mess about whether or not we collaborated with the foreign powers over. Now we'll see really how popular Trump is, because, you know, this whole media spectacle is not there anymore. And we did. And the reality is that most Americans who didn't like Donald Trump didn't like Donald Trump before the Mueller investigation.
Right.
And his approval rating now is exactly the same as it was before the investigation started, meaning that 58% of Americans just think Donald Trump's kind of an asshole. It has nothing to do with whether or not he was collaborating with a foreign power. It has a lot to do with the fact that he just kind of sucks. And he's a racist and a homophobe and trying to take away people's health care and constantly passing off falsehoods and mistruths and using propaganda constantly. People are still seeing that, just like they saw that in the first couple months of the administration. So, like, that hasn't changed. And I think what's been really fascinating about this week was watching the Trump administration try and sprint out of the gate after this was over, just to have to walk a whole bunch of stuff back. So we're going to talk a lot about immigration this week.
The collusion delusion is over.
Yeah, the collusion delusion is over. And what is the first thing Trump tried to do? He tried to say he was going to double down on repealing Obamacare. That was the first thing he tried to do. And said, oh, I'll take this to the courts. I'll do executive orders. We've got this big plan, blah, blah, blah. And then Mitch McConnell pretty much told him, we're not voting on repeal and replace. And so Trump comes out today. He's like, yeah, we'll do health care after the election. He ran out of the gate trying to kickstart essentially the 2020 campaign. And then had smack on the brakes really, really fast. Because the reality is he's still actually wildly unpopular. And repealing health care reform, repealing Obamacare, is still wildly unpopular.
Yeah.
How any of us individually feel about it, right?
You know, I think this really speaks to the fact that, you know, no matter what this media spectacle is, or the fact that we live in, you know, society of, you know, the viral spectacle, yeah. I mean, people's lives still are people's lives, and people still hate this, you know, capitalist system largely. Mm-hmm. People that experience it as wage slaves. And, you know, there was just a thing that just came out on Vice. There was some polling that was done with millennials, and it's found that about 50% of millennials favored multiracial, as they called it, militant labor movement. And, I mean, you know, take that for what it is. But, I mean, just, you know, you couple that with all the polls that show that more and more millennials, even a vast majority of them, are anti-capitalist, are open to anti-capitalist ideas. I mean, of course, none of that is represented within the mainstream discourse, but still, I mean, this is happening, and that's because, you know, people's lived experiences are very, very real, and people's, you know, expectations of what they want their lives to be are not matching up to what's being sold to them by the politics as usual.
Yeah, well, and those kinds of opinions and the frequency of those kinds of opinions within the millennial generation, what's interesting to me about that is that those numbers are pretty unchanged for the last 10 years or so. Like, they started running polls in Gawker and BuzzFeed and stuff like this 10 years ago, asking the question to millennials of whether or not millennials were anti-capitalist. And that was in 2009, when the oldest millennials, including myself, were in our mid-20s, right? And they were like, are you anti-capitalist? Everyone's like, yeah. And all these commentators in the mainstream media, when those first stories came out, talked about, oh, that's just youth. They'll grow up. They'll get more conservative. Yet 10 years later, now with that older group of millennials being in their mid to late 30s, they still have the same opinions. And that's very telling, right? The amount of millennials that are anti-capitalist has not changed in 10 years. Right.
You know, there was a really interesting thing I saw on Vice a couple days ago. It was about the scandal of children, or, you know, young adults that were basically, their parents were paying their way to get into Ivy League schools.
Oh, yeah.
And they had this thing where they had kind of like first generation, or, you know, basically working class kids that, you know, did really well in school and they had a scholarship and that's why they were there. And they had another section of legacy, or, you know, as self-described children that said, like, yes, I'm part of the 1%, or I'm, you know, upper middle class or something like that. And it didn't really say if their parents had, like, bought a library or, you know, what they did to get there. But, I mean, it was imply that they were very, very wealthy. And one of the things that was really interesting is in the wealthy group, they said, like, you know, I'm part of the campus newspaper. And they said the only reason that I can really do this is because I don't have to work. Like, you know, I go to class, you know, I don't have any job. Like, I don't have to basically make money to survive while I'm here. Like, I have my whole way paved. And like, that's who represents the people that are on the newspaper, because they have the time and energy to do that. So the people, you know, at that Ivy League school are all people from that same class background. And again, I mean, I think we saw this, especially like in the aftermath of, you know, the J20 and the Milo riot, you know, all these, you know, kind of like middle class people that really have never struggled for anything, you know, kind of start to write about anti-fascism and people fighting the outright. I mean, just kind of like these really milquetoast, soft hand wringing, you know, why would you ever go into the street to fight for something? Type stuff. And I mean, we continue to see this for, you know, in this context as well, just these people that are really very detached from reality. But I mean, I think there's a reason for that.
Yeah, I mean, but one of the things I think is happening in the Trump era, and the effects of this will take a while to play themselves out, but I think one of the things that's happening is it's becoming increasingly difficult for people who generally live lives which are outside of struggle to stay neutral anymore. That the outrages are so present, and I think the internet has a lot to do with this. There's no way to escape it anymore. You can't just tune it out. There's no way to escape it on your Facebook feed. There's no way to escape it on the news. Your coworkers are talking about it. This is probably the most politicized I've seen the U.S. public in a really long time, maybe ever. The only other time that's even mildly comparable is 2003. But really, I mean, this is a different level of engagement, regardless of what people's politics are. I mean, as more of a general dynamic. And we'll see what the long-term effects of that are. I mean, there's already plenty of sort of sociological evidence that's pointing to the idea that white college-educated middle-class voters who vote Republican for tax reasons won't be doing so again because they're concerned about things like racism and homophobia and abortion rights and things like that. That these people who generally tend to be socially liberal but incredibly selfish economically are starting to understand the impacts of what they do and starting to understand the impacts of the things that they support. And I think that kind of shift, even though that kind of shift is going to inherently heighten tensions inside the United States, that kind of shift is incredibly important, as are the heightening of tensions. I was having a discussion with an older person this week where, you know, they were giving me the pretty normal, like, well, you know, the Democrats need to get in power and then we need bipartisanship, blah, blah, blah. And I started to ask this person, like, you know, they had just gotten done ranting about Republicans being racist and Republicans being homophobic. And I asked them straight up, like, on an ethical or political level, is that something you should compromise with? And they were like, I never thought about that way. Probably not. That's an interesting indicator. The bipartisanship, the idea that we should have inherent political unity and compromise, is no longer the operative political category anymore. As more and more people start to get involved and get engaged in the kind of conflicts that are happening in the American social space right now, I don't know if there's any putting that back. I think we might be in for, even long after Trump is gone, a very different political reality than we were in when we got into this situation a couple of years ago.
And I think that's good. I mean, I think the next step with that would be for people to recognize themselves as part of a class that doesn't want to compromise with the ruling class. And beyond that, you know, people that live on a living earth that don't want to capitulate to a small group of capitalists that want to physically destroy the thing that keeps us alive. I mean, to me, that's a very fine line. I think that we should draw in the sand. It's like, you know, we want to actually continue to live on this planet. Like, we have no hopes of becoming robot appendages on Mars mining whatever the fuck. Like, you know, that's not a solution. Like, we would like to stay here and live, you know, be part of humanity instead of just continuing to deal with this incredibly fucked up industrial system. But
To take a page out of Carl Schmitt or Bonanno for a second, these kind of tensions are necessary, right? If we really think about what it takes to have concentrated moments of contestational activity, right? Moments where there's actual resistance, that does inherently involve people making a choice about who their friends are and who their enemies are. Mm-hmm. It inherently involves tension. It inherently involves choosing sides. And that's something that it's becoming increasingly impossible for people not to do. It's one of those scenarios which is never ideal. It's not something any of us should ever want, but is necessary at this moment in history where we end up finding ourselves now. And so, yeah, this is not going away anytime soon, I don't think. And that became very, very, very clear when people's opinions of the Trump administration didn't actually change when the Mueller investigation ended. What that shows is that those splits in the American social space right now are much deeper than I think a lot of people thought that they were.
Yeah, and especially as Trump has continued to have to double down on reaching out to his base that continues to be rabidly, I mean, not only anti-democratic, but in favor of, you know, autocratic authoritarian rule. Like, if you look at, like, some of the stuff that's, you know, centered around QAnon, like, it's literally like a fantasy of Trump, like, taking full, complete power and, like, being able to just, like, you know, take his political enemies and just, like, throw them in Guantanamo. I mean, it's like, you know, for a group of people that feel that they have been treaded on so hard by, you know, liberals and globalists, I mean, their idea of what they want is, you know, some version of fascism, which is, which is really terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, especially, like, you know, just this week, even as the media has been playing up the Jesse, you know, whatever happened in Chicago, you know, the falsification or whatever. I mean, there's in Tennessee, there was a historical training center for Southern and Appalachian organizers that famously Martin Luther King went and spent time there and took classes there. It was burned down. There was some white supremacist graffiti that was left at the scene that happened this week. Also in San Francisco, there's a guy that's in critical condition right now, was taunted with homophobic insults by a dude wearing a MAGA hat, and he pulled out a sword and almost cut the guy's hand off. The last report I read said his hand was almost severed. Yeah. So, you know, this continues to be the world that we live in.
Well, we need to wake up to that reality, too. I know that we've talked about the need for radicals to get really serious about operational security and self-defense.
Yeah.
And
there's actually a really great article that's on, it's going down right now, written by somebody that was once involved in the Redneck Revolt Network, and they have their own podcast now. But I strongly encourage people to check it out. It's really great because it talks a lot about the state's response in New Zealand to the mass shootings and basically using that as an example to basically clamp down, you know, under the pretext of assault weapons, but to kind of reaffirm its authority.
Yeah, we all need to be clued into this reality because, again, even after Trump is out of office, this is not going away anytime soon. He awoke something. He didn't create anything, but he awoke a dark part of the American psyche that I think a lot of us that were born and raised in the 1990s were taught was behind us. And it's very much not. And that reality, and there's been some really great discussions on NPR this week, if anyone's been listening, about South Africa, specifically around these kinds of questions of latent racial power dynamics in South Africa. This was also talked about on the Popular Front podcast, which if anyone wants a really good podcast to pick up outside of this one, Popular Front's amazing. Jake Hanrahan does an incredible job. And, like, if anyone really wants to nerd out about conflict stuff, that's definitely the place to do it because it's amazing. But one of the things that they talk a lot about there is, you're starting to see this rise of racialized violence again in South Africa, partially for very similar reasons that you're seeing it here in the United States. And that is that when apartheid ended, it didn't actually destroy racism.
No.
And when Jim Crow ended in the United States, it didn't actually destroy racism. Those things just sit there and fester latent in the sort of social space and have these moments of awakening.
No, well, and, I mean, especially in America where they literally change form. I mean, from racialized slavery to sharecropping to mass incarceration. I mean, it continues to change form. But just, you know, we're going to be talking extensively tonight about the so-called migrant crisis. But I mean, just to kind of piggyback on some of the stuff you were saying, this week I was watching some scientists do a talk on, I don't know, some YouTube channel about climate change. And they were pointing out, you know, the desertification and the displacement caused by climate change, which, you know, greatly impacted the amount of refugees that were created during the Syrian Civil War. Was about 1 million. And they were saying, just think about the amount of political, they called it political instability and the rise of far right wing populism in Europe. You know, everything that led to, from the rise of the AfD to Brexit to, you know, so on and so forth, you know, Bannon's the movement, all that stuff that we've talked about before on this program. That was 1 million people. They were saying in the next 15 years or so, or by the time we get to 2050, if, you know, trends continue, they're talking about tens of millions, if not 100 million refugees from the global south of the Americas coming north.
Yep.
And just think about, you know, the massive impact that would have. I mean, Trump right now is freaking out over, you know, a couple hundred to 1,000.
Yeah,
you know, refugees coming from countries that the United States has physically made unstable, has physically engaged in regime change. You know, again, I've said this before, but I find it disgustingly ironic that Trump can sit there and say, you know, lock her up, you know, talking about Hillary Clinton, where it was Hillary that was engaged in regime change in Honduras, and now the same people from that country are now coming to the United States because they have no other options left. And there's no one that he's even made that connection.
Well, when you combine these kind of massive shifts in global population with a deeply entrenched sense of white entitlement that forms everything that happens in the United States, what you have is you have a class of people, namely white Americans, specifically working class white Americans, that already in a lot of cases operate with a sense of entitlement combined with a sense of victimhood. And they will and have in the past defended their ability to maintain supremacy within a racial hierarchy within the United States very violently. And if we ever want to see that change, or even if we ever want to defend ourselves against the social impacts of that, we better start getting ready, because, you know, we need to form our communities. We need to be able to rely on people. We need to build networks of trust. Like, these things take time. And unfortunately right now we are a little bit behind the curve when it comes to that. Right. So we need to, I think a lot of us need a bit of a reality check about what our future will look like, because it's not happy. It's going to be pretty grim. And not only do we need to weather that, but as people who at least aspire to being able to fundamentally modify the way that we live our lives, we not only need to survive that, we need to excel in those kind of circumstances, because that's pretty much all we have left.
Right. Yeah. I mean, again, I want to say, if you haven't seen it, Alt-Right, Age of Rage, it's on Netflix. Even if you watch like the last like couple minutes, I think there's a really great quote actually from somebody from Chapo Trap House, where they say, you know, this is where the alt-right really plays a giant role in the fact that, you know, in the next couple decades, you know, all of these refugees are going to be headed our way. And the alt-right has been able to basically push this idea that these people just shouldn't exist. They should be genocided out of existence. They should be put into camps, you know, throw them out of helicopters, so on and so forth. And that, you know, the alt-right plays its role because it's, you know, psychologically preparing people to hold those positions.
Yes.
As opposed to saying, like, you know what? Actually, it's a lot easier to just fundamentally change the way that we live, that not only benefits us, but it benefits, you know, the planet and ensures that we can continue as a species.
Yeah, well, and the biggest barrier to doing so is often ourselves, right?
Right.
Our ability to self-limit our own political imagination, to limit what we think is possible, right? One of the things that has happened in the Trump era, which I think is potentially sets a stage for a very different political future, is that for a lot of people, there's no longer a choice to maintain what's going on anymore. And for even more people, there's no longer a choice to even go back to what it was like under Obama. That things have gone so far at this point that, you know, the structure of American politics and American power has become so nakedly shown to the world that it seems almost impossible for anyone at this point to try and justify maintaining the way things are or going back to the way things were. And for a lot of people, that's thrust them into a scenario in which they might not be able to imagine much of a political future, but they definitely don't want the political present. And that is a really interesting reality all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's interesting, but also scary, because Americans seem to have the tendency of waiting for a savior. I mean, just look at this, you know, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, the whole universal basic income thing. I mean, how many people are jumping on board on that? As if, you know, getting a couple hundred extra dollars a month is going to somehow save the crisis of, you know, what neoliberalism is, what is, you know, industrial civilization. I mean, it's not going to do anything in the face of that.
I think the question we have to ask anyone that we know who still holds on to positions like that is, you know, what have the last 70 years of liberal compromise gotten us, right? Because that's what we've lived in since World War II, has been 70 years or 80 years of liberal compromise, right? And where have we gotten, right? We've gotten Trump, right? We've gotten wealth stratification that's unparalleled in American history. We have a deeply, firmly entrenched underclass of people that are essentially economically hopeless, and a planet that's dying in the midst of an empire in collapse. That's what we've gotten out of 75 or 80 years of liberal compromise.
Well, not only that, but I would say an entrenched so-called left that is...
Oh, absolutely.
You know, yeah. That is part of the problem and continues to give people false hope.
Is another 8 years, 16 years, 20 years, whatever, of liberal compromise going to change that reality? I don't think it will. Even if that's what one prefers. Yeah. Even if one prefers to live in a world in which other people have sovereignty over our lives, even if that's what one prefers, can one make the argument that that's sustainable at this point? I don't think we can. And I think a lot of people are starting to come to that conclusion. They might not know what it means yet, but they're definitely getting to the point where the ability to justify compromise is very quickly disappearing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn now. We're going to jump into border stuff. You know, I think the first thing that we should talk about is that, you know, a couple months ago when Trump was talking about, you know, we're going to do the shutdown for the border, you know, a lot of people are pushing back and saying, like, well, look, you know, border crossings are at, you know, an all-time low, you know, in the last, you know, 10 or 12 years or so. And now the DHS is talking about, you know, there's this huge crisis and they're saying that there's an increase in border crossings. So did something happen over the last month? You know, what's going on? Is there just more people that are crossing right now? Is there another wave of caravans that's hit us? What's going on?
I mean, it's impossible to know how many people are crossing because not everyone gets caught, right? And this is always one of the difficulties about estimating the numbers of undocumented people in a space or the numbers of undocumented people that engage in any one specific activity, is because of the way that we deal with the movement of human people across space. Namely, we impose borders and a policing regime on that process. Because of that, people that cross the border without documents live an incredibly underground existence where they're not particularly super apt to talk to a bunch of sociologists about what they do with their time. And so it's really, really, really difficult to know whether or not more people are crossing. What we do know is that the Department of Homeland Security's detention policies have changed. And so in the past, what generally would happen is that you would cross, say you were from Honduras or El Salvador and you were crossing and you were attempting to claim asylum, you would cross just as people are doing now. You would voluntarily hand yourself over to the Border Patrol, just like people are doing now. And then essentially what they would do is they would go, okay, cool, do you have someone you can stay with? You go, yeah, sure, my cousin lives in whatever, El Paso or something. And they'd be like, great, go stay with your cousin, here's her court date. And tell you to show up at immigration court. That's traditionally what we've done in the United States. Because it's an actual viable, within the structure of the border enforcement regime, an actually manageable way logistically to handle that process, right?
And ICE is how old?
Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So in their current guise, ICE is a creation of the Department of Homeland Security, but they precede that. Their existence now, though, is as a sub-agency, right? So ICE is part of the general border enforcement. Border enforcement is comprised of a number of sub-agencies under Department of Homeland Security, including Border Patrol, Customs Border Patrol, ICE, INS. There's one more, I'm blanking on the acronym now. But there's a number of agencies that handle immigration-related things. So the policy of ICE now, though, is to essentially bring people in and detain them. And detain them essentially indefinitely. And they've been making this argument for indefinite detention for some time. We talked about this maybe last week, maybe the week before, the sort of legal precedences for indefinite detention and how they're grounded in Guantanamo Bay. But they're making a similar argument now. So what we do know about what's going on is that the detention facilities for migrants are overflowing. We absolutely do know that. And we know that they're packing people into cages inside detention centers. We also now know that they're packing people into cages under freeway overpasses in El Paso. Hundreds of people crammed into a cage under a freeway overpass with a single tent in El Paso, sleeping on cold gravel in the rain. That is symptomatic of a system which is overloading. And so the Department of Homeland Security did recently just release a statement saying the system's in meltdown. And that's probably true. But it's in meltdown simply because they changed the way that they handle migration. It's not necessarily in meltdown because there's more people crossing. There's no evidence to really demonstrate that. There's a lot of evidence to demonstrate that the way that DHS is handling migration at this point, especially asylum claims, is pushing the system to the point of breaking. Now, the way that they handle that is a different question, and we'll get into that probably in a little bit, because things like detaining people under freeway overpasses are intentional decisions to detain people out in the open in horrific conditions. And that's a choice that's being made. There's plenty of other ways that they could have handled that problem of overcrowding. But we do know that the system probably is at the point of breaking right now. The immigration court system already was way overloaded. But now the detention facilities are getting overloaded because they're just detaining people indefinitely at this point.
Yeah, and if you haven't been paying attention, you know, in the last couple of days, Department of Homeland Security basically has issued this letter saying, like, as you said, look, the system's in meltdown. We need a couple things. We need lots more money. We need more facilities to be built. And then they also said that what they wanted was they wanted laws, you know, on the books that basically prevent them from detaining people for a long amount of time and also separating children. They wanted those basically to be done away with so they could continue to do what they're doing on an even larger level.
Yeah, well, and if we contextualize all of that, right? So government agencies pretty consistently make this very strange claim that everything they're doing is horribly broken and they need more money. The Defense Department makes this claim every single year, essentially, as do a lot of U.S. government agencies. What's funny about that claim is that the people that are making that argument are essentially saying, I'm failing at my job, please give me more money. And so there's various ways to demonstrate that. So like the military, what they do, and I've heard this from numerous people that I know that have spent time in the military, they go on these buying sprees at the end of the budget year and like give everybody five pairs of shoes and stuff because they have to spend the money to show that they need more money. Because if they have money left over at the end of the budget cycle, well, obviously they're not going to get more next year. So they continually just blow the money in order to get higher budgets. In the Trump era, though, this has looked different. And what I mean by that is that the Trump administration has this process that they seem to go through, where what they do is they manufacture a crisis. And in manufacturing that crisis, they create the image of human tragedy and then try and leverage that human tragedy in order to achieve policy goals. So there are many examples of this. We can go back to the Muslim ban, right? The first attempt to ban Muslims from the United States. It was very transparent that that's what they were trying to do. They tried to impose it through executive order. And what did people do? Well, they came out to the airports, but only after there were stories of people working as doctors in the United States that couldn't get back to their jobs because they weren't formal citizens and were from Saudi Arabia or something, or parents who were getting separated from their children whose kids were in the United States, but they were trying to fly back from, you know, visiting family overseas and couldn't get back into the country, right? There were these kind of horrific tragedies that forced organizations like the ACLU to intervene. And through those interventions, that called all these people out into the streets, right? Trump was hoping that by creating a crisis, he would get his Muslim ban, and eventually did get a very minimal version of a right to do a thing like that through the courts, but in a very pared down way. You can also see a similar move when they were trying to when the Trump administration was trying to eliminate protections for Dreamers, right? What they did was they issued an executive order saying, we're going to take protections away from these millions of people, all of which were born in the United States, have never lived anywhere else. We're going to take protections away from all those people. And Congress has, I think it was like 4 or 5 months to figure out what to do about that. And if Congress can't figure it out, well, we'll just send ICE out and just round people up and throw them into camps. So the administration was essentially threatening to detain a bunch of people who were born in the United States in concentration camps if they didn't get their way on immigration policy. Right. I mean, we're watching a number of things play out just this week, kind of on these lines. So the first is, well, Department of Homeland Security has overflowed its detention centers for migrants. So instead of, you know, using all this military money that they freed up because of the so-called national emergency to build detention space, they're detaining people under a freeway overpass in El Paso. Why would you do that? Right. You could put people anywhere else. Well, the reason you do that is for the pictures. There's images now of people suffering under a freeway overpass. And they think that that's going to give them the ability to get more budget money, right? They cut off foreign aid to Central American countries this week, which is going to heighten the humanitarian crisis there and is going to cause more people to come up north. And that is going to, again, reinforce this idea that there's a crisis at the U.S. border. And so what the Trump administration is literally doing is they are using people, regular people, individual people, many of which are already escaping relatively difficult circumstances, essentially as props in some grand theatrical act where they're trying to convince everybody through the sheer cruelty of their own actions that we have to do something, that they're going to manufacture a crisis, they're going to create as much pain as they possibly can, and then they're going to demand that we do something to stop what they're doing, essentially, while in the process blaming the whole process on somebody else. That kind of mode of doing things is something that all of us, regardless of our moral proclivities or ethical sort of tendencies, should be outraged by, right? The fact that individual people are being used and exploited essentially for Donald Trump's political gain is atrocious. And like, yeah, all politicians do this, right, to some degree or another. The difference is it's so overt and so catastrophic at this point that it's almost unimaginable. One of the things that terrified me at the end of the Mueller investigation, and I mentioned this last week, was my concern that the administration was going to act as if they had no limitations anymore. And that's very much what they did try to do this week. And the impacts of that could be pretty catastrophic, essentially, especially considering that, you know, we give aid to Central American nations, the U.S. government does, partially to deal with the outcomes of things we did, right? We were the ones that either crushed or overthrew people's uprisings in Central America all through the 70s and 80s. It was our fault that military dictatorships ran around Guatemala murdering thousands of people, right? Or that death squads existed in El Salvador. That was our fault. We trained those people. We armed those people. That was our fault. All happened under the Reagan administration. And foreign aid is, in a way, part of a process of at least eliminating the worst of the blowback from that. But by eliminating that, essentially what we're telling people there is, well, yeah, we screwed up your entire social circumstance, but we're also not going to help. And good luck. And if you try and cross here, we're just going to make you stay in Mexico for potentially years on end while we work out your immigration case. Because at the end of the day, what the Trump administration is trying to do is they're trying to force a change in immigration policy, both in the U.S. and in Mexico simultaneously. And they're using human tragedy as a tool in that process. And they're creating these kind of spectacles of suffering. That is something which is absolutely fucking unforgivable, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, agreed. So I think this all begs the question, too, is that, you know, what does Trump want to get out of this? Why is he saying that, you know, he's going to shut down the border? You know, what is he, you know, strategically, what's he going about doing? Is it just to pander to his base?
So shutting down the border is a profoundly stupid idea for anyone that's trying to preserve the ability of American capitalism to function. They're just... As an example of the possible economic cost of shutting the border down, some migrants from the most recent caravan, the one that ended up in Tijuana, decided to try and storm a border checkpoint. This was a few months ago. And at that border checkpoint, the Border Patrol shut down that checkpoint for like 2 hours or something. And just that one checkpoint for 2 hours cost the U.S. economy over $5 million. Then articles today, the projections are that if Trump were to actually shut down all the land crossings on the southern border into the United States, it would cost the U.S. economy over $1 billion a day in lost trade. Not just lost trade, but also not just trade in the sense of like trade that we have in Mexico, but most of those companies that are sending stuff into the United States are American-owned companies. They're companies like General Motors, right, or Walmart, who do a lot of manufacturing in maquiladoras in northern Mexico. So not only does that mean that generally there will be a pretty significant economic hit if you were to do this, also the goods that we buy in the United States will yet again become more expensive if we could even get them at all, right? I think a lot of Americans are unaware of how much of our economic activity is almost entirely dependent on Mexico and countries in Central America. It's in the trillions of dollars a year. And what that means is that our economic life, as we understand it, is inherently tied to the very same places that we're the administration right now is trying to punish, essentially, for not unilaterally following its will. It's a profoundly stupid idea, and it's unlikely that it's going to happen in the way that, that the administration is portraying that it will, even though they continue saying, this isn't a bluff, this isn't a bluff. So why would he be doing this, right? And I think that's the operative question. See, spectacles of suffering... What they do is they create the image that there's a kind of grand social dissolution going on, that there's some profound social crisis that requires strong action in order to mitigate. To understand this, all anyone needs to do is just watch Fox News in the evening for like a couple of hours. Yeah, it's really painful, but people should do it. I, in fact, really highly encourage anyone to spend a little bit of time watching at least some of what the hell is going on Fox News. And that could be like watching Sean Hannity or Laura Ingraham for a little while. Don't watch Tucker Carlson. He's worthless. But someone like Laura Ingraham or Sean Hannity, they're more kind of in line with the sort of mainstream of Fox News. And I mean, they've been pushing this idea for the last year that there's this profound social breakdown going on in the United States, and that Donald Trump is the only person that can save us from that. And Trump did very much run on that idea. And he ran on that idea while grounding the crisis in the idea of immigration, which was clearly a racist dog whistle. So a lot of what's going on at this point is he's trying to manufacture the image of a crisis, not necessarily to fix it, not necessarily to win any policy wins, but he's manufacturing the crisis as an act in the sort of grand play that he's staging right now, which he's calling his reelection campaign. You saw it at the rally he gave in Michigan this week, where he talked endlessly about how immigrants were flooding into the country and it was an invasion and blah, blah, blah. Look at all these people under the freeway overpass and how awful is it that we don't have enough room in our detention centers for people. And I mean, he's, if you can say many things about Donald Trump, but he's profoundly transparent because he's not smart enough not to be. And so a lot of this is about riling up the base. Mick Mulvaney said essentially that today. The problem Trump is going to have, though, by playing this strategy, is that every time he does something like this, he alienates more and more people, right? This kind of moderate middle, which is what, you know, in polling they call the independents, right? Which is really what they mean is like moderates. The moderate middle, your college-educated suburban white people, essentially, will vote for tax breaks, but they won't vote for tax breaks if it means stealing children from their parents. And so as Trump continues to play these strategies towards his base, what you're watching is his prospects for re-election dropping dramatically. I don't think anyone should ever discount the ability of the Democratic Party to completely screw up an overwhelming advantage, because they do it all the time, literally. But every time Trump does this, it damages his ability to get reelected. I think the biggest problem is he doesn't have any other strategy to play at this point. He can't walk it back because he would look weak. So it's unclear what else he could be doing, I think. And that's actually the most dangerous thing, is that for as awful as this all is, if you're in Trump's orbit, it's the only thing he could be doing right now. There's really no other options. He can't stand on the veracity of his policy agenda because there isn't one. He can't talk about the depth of his experience because there isn't any. He can't talk about his ability to manage companies because he sucks at it. And he can't talk about his achievements in office because there aren't many. And so what he's got to run on is he has to run on racism. And that's what he's trying to do. The problem is that that message doesn't resonate with as many people as I think that they think it does. And that just has to do mostly with demographics than anything else. I'm in no way trying to claim that like white Americans are not super racist, because they are. What I am trying to claim is that there's less of them all the time. And that those demographic shifts, which are happening very much so in the United States right now, in which the United States is becoming less white and younger all the time, it doesn't necessarily bode well for kind of racist dog whistle politics. And we'll see how much those changes matter when we get up to the next election cycle. But for right now, what Trump is doing is playing the only strategy he has, and that's a losing strategy. But that's a really dangerous place for us to be in right now, because he really has no impetus to pull back from anything.
So yeah, we've kind of like outlaid the strategy, you know, pandering to his base. I mean, does the state get anything else out of this other than just Trump, you know, solidifying what he already has? I mean, I think the other question is like, if they're saying that the system is in meltdown, then why put so many people in detention? Like, seems like they're dancing kind of on hot coals here.
They absolutely are. And it's that's required by the strategy they're playing. So from the very beginning, they've played the strategy of sort of the spectacle of tragedy, right? And you saw this from the very first speech Trump gave when he came down the escalator in Trump Tower. That was a speech about a collapsing American social fabric that he blamed on immigration. If you look at his inauguration speech, right, the now kind of infamous American Carnage speech that he gave on his inauguration day, that wasn't the typical hopeful speech that you hear people give when they get inaugurated as president of the United States. It was, in fact, this very dark vision of a world that was sort of imploding on itself, and this kind of small group of American patriots who were going to hold the line against tyranny, right? And he's built his entire political brand on this idea. And so he's stuck now, because he can't have anything other than tragedy. If he has anything other than tragedy, there's no reason for anyone to vote for him. But at the same time, tragedy is a losing strategy, because though things are breaking down, they're not breaking down in as immediate or as catastrophic a way as you would think by watching right-wing media or listening to Donald Trump speak. And so he's stuck in this process now where he can either continue to manufacture tragedy, at which point he will likely lose in 2020. Or he can stop manufacturing tragedy and lose his base, at which point he will definitely lose in 2020. What they don't have, what they haven't created at all, is any conditions in which to construct a solution to the problem. So you, the problem that they're very much in themselves kind of creating. So you look at the Department of Homeland Security right now. Well, they can't detain fewer people, because if they detain fewer people, well, that erodes the idea that there's a crisis. And if there's no crisis, they don't get their budget increase next year. And so they're sort of stuck, because they've presented the entire idea of their necessity on their own failure. They've essentially said, we have failed so badly to control the thing that we're telling you is a problem that you need us to control the thing that we're telling you is a problem. And it's a nonsensical argument. We also have to keep in mind, though, that that right-wing discourse at this point doesn't revolve around arguments. There are no arguments anymore. There are momentary, reactionary outrages, and that's it. And so as long as they can keep the pace of momentary, reactionary outrage going, they can maintain the support of their base. But that kind of pace of momentary, reactionary outrage is a pace which is exhausting and magnetizing fewer and fewer people all the time. And so do I think that they're looking for concrete changes? Not ones that are achievable, right? They're not going to get the immigration policy they're pushing for because they don't control the House of Representatives. They're not going to get the immigration policy they really want, which, you know, if you go back to the early parts of the administration, was essentially to end immigration. They're not going to get that because it's racist and no one will vote for it. So they're essentially stuck in this process of having to constantly remind people that this crisis that they keep telling everyone exists is actually a thing that exists. Because if they stop doing that, they'll fade into obscurity. That's all that they have left. And so it's not about concrete solutions. It's not about solving the problem that they created. It's purely about maintaining the image that the problem still exists through the next election cycle. That seems to be their only game right now.
Yeah, I do want to say this, though, and this is going to be kind of swept under the rug, but I mean, if you look online right now, I mean, there's hunger strikes popping up at detention facilities. There was just a march, I believe, in one city of actually former Japanese internment camp survivors marched in Texas, actually on the border, against the detention of migrants right now. There's a call from the Block the Wall Network for a month of action starting in April, going to May 1st. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's starting to kind of rumble. And, you know, the only other point I would make tonight is that I feel like what we've learned under Trump is the limits of viral activism, you know, kind of waiting for, you know, the baby to be electrocuted by the guard, and that video is going to go viral, and that's going to suddenly cause a lot of people to go into the street. I mean, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, we see, you know, how much fucked up shit do we see every single day? And, you know, that doesn't cause people to go into the street. I mean, very rarely does it kind of push us to make those big leaps. And I think it shows that if we fall back on that, if we kind of wait for that, then, you know, we're just going to be in a constant cycle of waiting for something to pop off because of social media or hashtag getting real popular, which again then puts a lot of power on, you know, quote unquote influencers, mm-hmm. to be able to make things to go viral, as opposed to people having the capacity and the ability through organization, and by that I mean physically being organized, not necessarily being, you know, a card-carrying member of an organization, mm-hmm. but having, you know, the capacity, ability to organize themselves and infrastructure to take action and to, you know, manifest something to take place.
Well, and I think if we learned anything from the Mueller experience, it's that this process that the left and post-left tends to be caught in consistently, which is that we wait for outrages and then we engage in these kind of discursive symbolic activist activities, that kind of reactionary process constantly fails. That not only are we unable to actually understand what we're fighting in that kind of mode because we reduce it down to some sort of abstract moral outrage and not an actual like material logistics that we can break apart and understand and start to disrupt, that kind of organizing fundamentally prevents us from being able to do that, but it also consistently prevents us from being able to seize initiative and gain momentum. And so right now, of all things that people need to do, we need to stop relying on the administration to provide us with the fodder to get out into the streets, and we need to just start doing it, right? We need to seize momentum, and we need to fight for our own reasons, right? We need to sit there, and we need to decide that we're done with all of this, and we need to take actions that will actually move towards ending it. It's not enough to just complain about it, and it's not enough to just carry signs, and it's not enough to wait for outrage. What we need to do is we need to start to very seriously consider what it would look like for us to, in a very real way, start to challenge the functionality of the American state. We have to do it. We don't have a choice anymore. I think in the past, for a lot of us, we made decisions to be involved in subversive activity. At this point, there's no longer much of a decision to be made. You're either, you know, choosing the side of contestation, or you're choosing the side of planetary heat death, poverty, right, immigration detention centers. That's the only question really left. And if one does choose to reject the things that are going on right now, then one is also choosing fundamentally to start to spot out points where they can intervene. And those points can be anywhere, right? We don't have to wait. We're not members of some Leninist party where some party chairman is telling us to wait for the right moment in history, because every moment is the right moment, and every space is a space to intervene, and we just need to make the decision about which space and when we're going to decide to act. We don't have to wait for somebody else to push us there, and we don't have to wait for organizations to start organizing, and we don't have to wait for social movements to start. We can do this stuff on our own. I think anarchists in the United States and around the world have shown this repeatedly, over and over and over again, that we can do direct action without having to rely on massive numbers of people to be able to engage in such activity. And we need to start thinking along those lines again. As I've said time and time again, whenever we partner with liberals in social movement contexts, we usually get stabbed in the back, and we need to never forget that lesson. We need to also not forget the lesson that, as far as my involvement has been, anarchists very rarely have relied on external activities to push us into action. We've always been willing to go there on our own, and we need to be willing to do that again.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.